Let's just say my need for touch is lacking. I tell people, write a list of ways that you can satisfy these needs with money, right? Maybe you go and get a massage on a regular basis. And then equally important is, how do you satisfy these needs without the use of money? This is where we break our dependency on money.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and our guest today is brilliant. I cannot wait to share her with you today. Our guest is Elizabeth Husserl. She is a registered investment advisor, representative financial advisor, and co-founder of Peak 360 Wealth Management, a boutique wealth planning firm. She holds a BA in economics from Tulane and a master's in East-West psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies. She's been a professor. She speaks all over the world. She's so sought after. She has led workshops for Airbnb, Unity, and Google. But she's here to talk to us today about her new book, The Power of Enough, Finding Joy in Your Relationship with Money, which is available everywhere. Can't wait to dive into this. Elizabeth, welcome to the Daily Helping. It is awesome to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Richard. I'm so excited to be here. So the conversation is going to be exciting, fun, enlivening, and bring joy to our relationship to money. So thank you for having me.
And I'm excited. Absolutely. And why I'm so excited is because a lot of times, which I'm sure your book details, people have this unhealthy relationship with money, or, you know, you see this a lot, even in comments and social media, where people have this inherent distrust of wealth, dislike of wealth. So we're going to dive into this. But I want to go into the Elizabeth Husserl time machine. So take us back. I want to explore your superhero journey. So what put you on the path you're on today?
That's a great question. So many things, but if I were to highlight a couple things, there's the personal lineage of really wanting to explore, why is it that there was the feeling of scarcity in my family, even though I was raised by two working professionals, right? My dad was a doctor, my mom was a therapist, or is a therapist. She still continues to practice. But there was this feeling of tightness around money, and I couldn't understand why, right? And so, you know, after diving into conversations with my dad and realizing my grandfather was an Austrian Jew who had to leave Europe at the end of the, or during the Second World War, and that's how he ended up in Colombia, South America, where my parents met, I was like, oh, I started to realize how scarcity, the experience of scarcity that was very true to my ancestors, started getting passed on, and we still continued to live under that energetic framework. And I was like, how do we do a software update for my family, right? How do we not pass on this experience of scarcity if it's not actually true? Because in reality, that experience of scarcity was marking a lot of how I was dealing with money. And it was becoming confusing, conflictive. It just didn't feel good. And so that was kind of the personal lineage journey around it. And on the other flip side, you know, my passions in life, I love math and figuring out problems, which is why I went and studied economics. But I love the human psyche and people, right? It's almost like my dad taught me the science of medicine, although never wanted to be a doctor. And my mom taught me the beauty of psychology and the importance of understanding who we are. And so these two passions have always guided my work, right? And so I did economics as my undergrad. And then when I graduated, I was like, huh, where can I go experience economics kind of apply to the human component? And that's where I ended up in Oaxaca, working for a nonprofit and doing community economics programs for a local nonprofit and working with indigenous women, starting savings and loan cooperatives. And it was in Oaxaca that a different experience of wealth was put into my face, right? Like I'd go in and I would teach them different things that were really important, right? Tangible tools on how they could create saving cooperatives amongst themselves. But then I would sit in these communities, in these villages, and be like, huh, there's something here that I don't sometimes experience back in the States, where people have a lot more material wealth, but don't feel the same wealth of the resources that are available in some of these villages, right? And I don't mean to romanticize it, but I was able to experience a different perspective of wealth that has marked me since my early 20s. And so when I left Oaxaca after 2 years of working in the nonprofit and I came back to the States, I was like, huh, my work is here. And my work is to answer the question, why is it that we have so much, right, comparatively speaking, and yet we don't feel wealthy? What is that about? So that's been the overarching question that I dove into. You know, I got my master's in psychology, then I've been working in financial planning for 15 years, and I've just been always bringing these two aspects together. And the book is kind of the culmination of that journey and everything that I've learned. And I tell people it's an invitation to take a journey in yourself and in your own relationship to money to see what do you learn when you start to unravel, right, the lineage you come from, the money story that you've created, and your own patterns and beliefs. So, you know, it's been such a fruitful journey for myself that I wanted to offer that to the rest of the world.
I love this. So I imagine your answer is going to be complex and multifaceted. But so you're in Oaxaca. Yeah. People seemed really happy with what they have, even though over here, materially, we have much more. And then you dove into that question, why do we as Westerners, perhaps more specifically American Westerners, but why do we have this unhealthy relationship with money? And what did you turn up to find?
So what I discovered is it's a lot of it has to do with how we define wealth, which is like the opening piece of the book, right? And so, you know, and I remember this, Dr. Richard, being in college and being taught economics, and economics was taught or is taught and for a lot of people is the allocation of scarce resources. So we implicitly connect economics and wealth to scarcity, right? And what happens is that in the West, I have found us that we start to really hone in on one part of the wealth mandala, as I call it. So what happens in the West is that we get so fixated on one part of how we define wealth, which is financial stability, and so narrow-minded that we forget to raise the gaze and look at the other aspects that define wealth and connect wealth to well-being, right? And so this was a lot of work that Maslow brought in the 60s when he started talking about human needs, right? And needs not just for safety and survival, but needs for self-actualization. So there's a way in which you start to bring in this conversation of human needs, right? That include belonging and connection and purpose and participation and touch and safety. And when you start to bring that into our conversation of wealth, we realize that we actually are wealthy. We are wealthy in some of these other areas, even if we're trying to figure out our need for financial stability. And so my experience in Oaxaca was that they had a wider perspective, because I think that is just a natural way that humans interact with the world if they don't have a certain cultural assumption, right? And I think in the West, there's a cultural assumption of defining wealth in monetary terms and connected to scarcity. These villages that I was working in didn't have that assumption. They had a different cosmological view that connected their communities to nature, to their own expression of spirituality, to each other. So what I experienced there, Dr. Richard, was a generosity of spirit, right, that was deeply embedded in their interactions. And yes, they would roll up their sleeves. And I think the two needs that I saw them most concerned about was their need for safety, right? So I was working in an indigenous village, and they were really fighting for their ability to practice their political ways, right? So it wasn't that everything was rosy and taken care of, but they experienced connection and shared resources differently than what I see here in the West. And so in the West, not only do we connect wealth with scarcity, we also do it very individualistically, right? And we forget to lean on our communities to be able to expand our experience of resource, right? Resources don't have to be tangible and limited. Some are, but not all resources are tangible and limited, right? If you think of creativity, if you think of connection, if you think of support, if you think of curiosity, these are resources that we can lean into, especially if we're sharing them collectively, and use that as a way to experience and develop wealth.
One of the things you said earlier was that there are things that, even though it may not be the monetary, because you sit here in the West, we're really tied not only to scarcity, but the perception of financial stability. But yeah. You said that we, as Westerners, are wealthy in many other areas. Could you name a few of those areas? Because I'm curious as to what those are, and I wonder how that differs from other cultures.
Well, you know, one that I perhaps would take for granted, right, is the need for safety. There is a way in which, you know, I've lived in different countries, and I generally feel a degree of safety in the States that sometimes I haven't felt in other countries. I think that perhaps not everyone is feeling that at all times. So I don't want to make a blanket statement, right? Because our sense of safety could be our sense of safety around identity, about different things. But generally speaking, I live in a democratic system, right? That gives me a sense of safety and checks and balances. That's not something to take for granted in other countries, for example. So that's one. I would say in the States, there is very much an experience of a drive for purpose, right? That doesn't mean that everyone knows what their purpose is, but generally speaking, if you tell someone, you know, I'm wanting to align my work with purpose, that's possible here. Again, that's not possible in some other countries, right? Where sometimes work is very much around survival, right? And it's less differentiated. So I would say everywhere we live has its shadows and its wisdom, right? And so one of the things that I most liked or that I've really appreciated in my journey of studying, you know, and uncovering the research that went into this book was the opportunity to work with an economist who was from Chile. His name was Manfred Max Neef. And he took Maslow's works around needs one step further. And he made the distinction that, okay, let's have a starting point that our needs are universal, right? And so we have these set of needs that are universal. So let's stop talking about being needy or not being needy. We have universal human needs, but the way we satisfy them is personal and unique to who we are. And I found that to be such a unique distinction, because it does allow us to have creativity and difference in how we satisfy needs. He was an economist from Chile, and he was really arguing for Latin American countries to be like, hey, you can satisfy your needs in ways that are different, for example, than the US or different countries that potentially are trying to interfere in our policies. But I think if you bring that down to the personal level, there's the ability to have agency in how we design our lives. And that's something that I do feel is very predominant in our culture, is the ability to have agency and choice, or at least the possibility of.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I'm enjoying this so much because we're looking at wealth in very different ways. We're forcing ourselves, rather, to look at wealth in different ways. Even the title of your book is, to me, provocative, right? The power of enough. We really never think about enough. And I suppose in your world of estate planning and whatnot, there has to be the number. So what's your safety net number so somebody can retire and do what they want to do? But most people, when they think about money, certainly most businesses, it's just how big can it get, right? It's never, oh, when I get to this number, I'm going to stop and smell the roses and look back right. with gratitude on all that I have achieved. It's how much more? It's more and more and more. So just the fact that the title of the book is setting the framework for us to understand and look at money differently is exciting to me. And again, you know, the subtitle, Finding Your Joy in Relationship with Money. We know that there's, for so many people, such an unhealthy relationship, a distrust of money. So let's start with the enough, right? Let's start with enough and then just
let's go there.
Going down from there.
Yeah, let's go there, Dr. Richard, because what's really important, I mean, I love the fact that I get to talk about money with people every day. Like, I love my job, right? Because people come into the office and I kid you not, 9 out of 10 people will walk in and say, Elizabeth, I want so much money, I don't have to think about it. Right? That's often a sentiment that we have, right? And I just smile and I kind of nod my head. I'm like, okay, let's start digging a little bit deeper there. And in reality, what they're trying to tell me is money creates angst, right? Because there's this feeling of not enough. And when am I ever going to get to that place where I can relax into it, right? And so we've created this notion of retirement. I have so much money or enough money to support my life that I don't have to think about it. Now, the misnomer is that actually when you're in retirement, my clients that are in retirement sometimes think more about money than those clients that are saving for retirement, because they're so busy in their work life and they're producing and they're just, it's a different experience in time, right? Whereas when you're in retirement, you're like, oh my gosh, now the worry is, will I keep it? Will I outlive it? Will I make great decisions with it? Do you see that? And so what I tell people is that your emotions and your relationship to money never goes away. So let's start getting super clear about what's underneath that relationship to money and the emotions today, so that you can start enjoying your life and creating, creating a space where money doesn't define you as a human and you and your purpose and you and your passions today. Because if we don't do that work today, it doesn't matter how much you save. You're never going to be able to relax into your relationship to money, right? And so what ends up happening is that we scapegoat money. And we say we want so much of it that I don't have to think about it, right? Or I want to keep saving. We like money to go in one direction, which is up, right? To your point around companies who want to continue to make more. But we never stop to say, hey, what's my goalpost? How do I even know where I arrived? And it does require rolling up your sleeves and doing financial planning, right? I have a job for a reason. But it also equally requires you understanding what are the emotional triggers, right? And can you create practices in your life today that allow you to experience fulfillment, satiation, and the power of enough every day in your life. So that's the biggest argument. Because if you can't experience those things, you are in a codependent relationship with money. And we know that codependency doesn't work in our marriages, right? Or in our relationship to spouses or kids or anyone. We know that. So why aren't we applying it to our relationship to money, which is a relationship that every single person has? Unless you're living by yourself on an island, right? So let's, again, accept the fact that we're in relationship with money. Money is just waiting there to be included into your life and to hash out the ways that you all are getting along or not, right? And to help you experience not only satiation, but clarity on what are potentially some of those areas that you're feeling angst. Because it's not going to go away, the reality. It doesn't matter how much money you have. I work with people on the full wealth spectrum. The angst doesn't go away until you turn and look at it.
So somebody's listening to this and they're nodding their head in agreement. Yep. You know what, Elizabeth, that's me. I'm always worried. When's the other shoe going to drop?
Yeah.
What are some of the first steps that listener should be taking to start improving their relationship with money?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many first steps. And I'm the first to say, Dr. Richard, like, I wrote this book for myself. Right. Again, I come from a lineage where I experienced a ton of scarcity, and I cannot tell you how many years of my life I have lived attached to my spreadsheet, tracking everything coming in, going out. Is it growing? So I know what that experience is like. And I remember the day when I closed my computer and I said, get off the spreadsheet, Elizabeth. This is not making you feel any more fulfilled in your life. Right. So A, I had to start digging deep into what am I feeling anxious about? What do I not know? And I'm feeling unclear. And so I use, there's a lot of practical techniques that I talk about in the book, right? One of them, one of my favorites is sitting down. I know it sounds crazy for some people, but sit down and you have a conversation with money. It is a pretty standard therapeutic technique called the empty chair exercise, where you put money in a chair in front of you. And you can do this literally where you're having an outward conversation with money. You can do this in your journal, but you start to see, okay, money, this is what I feel about you. Right. And so I remember Dr. Richard, and I talk about this in the book, when I had my first conversation with money, and I'm like, God damn it, money, why don't you show up in my life? I was so angry at it. And I went on and on and on and on. And I told it all the things that like would trouble me about it. And then the beauty of this technique is that at some point when you feel, as complete as you can, right, when you rant, right, and if you don't feel complete, put a timer on your phone so that at some point you stop, you switch chairs. And now your money talking back to you. And the invitation here is to be an open listener, be like, hey, if I were to go to therapy with money and I'd give money an opportunity to respond to me, what would it say? And it was fascinating what money told me, right? Money was like, Elizabeth, you are smothering me. You're holding on too tight. You have all these questions about becoming an entrepreneur that you need help getting answered. Go find support in that. And it was like such a wake up call, because I was like, money's totally right. I was starting my private practice, but no one had taught me how to have a private practice. And I was like, okay, money, you are totally right. I have these list of questions, and guess what? You're not going to solve them for me. So let me go actually start to lean into my community. Who in my world is an entrepreneur? Who can help me start to answer these questions? That is my responsibility to start to address. And then once we started to do that, and I kept coming back to conversation with money, money's like, yeah, let's do this. Now let's sit down and get super clear. What are your rates? Let's get super clear. What is your business plan? And money, funny enough, started to actually become an ally, almost like a board member and a friend in that process. So it was really important, Dr. Richard, for me to say, okay, how am I scapegoating my relationship to money because I'm angry or frustrated or scared or feeling abandoned, whatever emotion that you want to put to it or feeling? How am I scapegoating my relationship to money? And what are ways that I can start to take responsibility for that and really get clear what pertains to the world of money and what does not?
I love the empty chair technique. I've had people do it stuffed animals, right? And yes. So, I'm just imagining this plush, like 12-inch $100 bill with a face on it, you know, in a chair, yes, as we're talking to it. But so this starts the framework, right? This begins a person thinking about money as a vehicle that can help them rather than something that is holding them back from whatever it is they want to achieve. But there's a difference too between, you know, being okay with money and then having joy,
yeah,
with money, right? So let's kind of, you know, that was the first step, right? Is start having the conversation with money. Once we start making peace with money, what do we do next?
Okay, great question. I'm loving this arc, this journey that you're taking listeners on. So next, right? And so from the conversation with money, just to kind of connect to what I said last is, we get clear what pertains to the world of money, what does not, right? Set that aside for a second. And then there's two more steps to do. A very simple one is start to bring awareness to what are those things that bring fulfillment, right? And so it's kind of, I call it the satiation paradigm. And what's really important is that we can get stuck in this abundance scarcity loop. And I talk about this in the book, where we're trying to push scarcity away by grasping onto abundance, right? I want more, 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 because I want to push scarcity away. And if you do that, right, you're pushing and you're grasping, both of those gestures or body positions require tension, right? And so the invitation is to let your body relax for a second and start to recognize what are the ways that you are naturally satisfied and fulfilled in your life. And so a simple way to do this is to take a 30-day satiation challenge. And I tell people, grab a journal or an application on your phone. And at the end of the day, for 30 days, write three things that satisfied you, right? So for me, it's often a meaningful conversation. So Dr. Richard, you will make my list tonight because I love meaningful conversations. Whenever I get to sit and have a conversation with my teenage daughter at breakfast, that always makes the list. Whenever I get to take, you know, a lunchtime walk around the block in between meetings, that makes my list. And so you start to recognize over 30 days, what are those things that you actually know how to do to add a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction to your life? And so it's not a gratitude practice. It's not what you're thankful for, but it's a satiation practice, which is what do you do that starts to fill that cup, right? That I know how to bring through agency and design a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction. And you just start to practice that. And what happens is that when you start to bring awareness to it and you compound these moments of meaning, the same exercise, right? When we compound interest in our savings or investment accounts where interest grows on it and we start to see growth in our portfolios, we started to see the same growth internally around our ability and confidence and being able to design a life that's satisfying. So again, that's a very simple technique to build that muscle. Then the other technique, which takes a little bit more kind of effort, is to then gauge and to do the exercise of the wealth mandala, which is my take on human needs. And again, I talk about this in the book, and there's a free resource on my website that people can download to do this practice. And what it means is print out this one piece of paper, and the wealth mandala, mandala means circle in Sanskrit, and they use mandalas as a practice of moving from suffering to joy. That's what it is. And so you take this wealth mandala and it outlines the 12 human needs that we all have. And there's two little empty spaces. If you want to add a need that I didn't name, that's really important to you, by all means. And you take a moment to be like, okay, in each of these needs, how fulfilled am I experiencing myself in that, right? We could say how wealthy I am in that need, how lacking am I in that need. And you color the mandala, like you color it all the way to the edge if you're feeling fully satisfied. You barely color it if you're feeling total lack in it. And then you do the coloring. I tell people, put it on the wall, Dr. Richard, and for a moment, embrace it as if it were this beautiful flower. And flowers are imperfect in their beauty, right? Their petals are not all the same. And so first, just take in this image of your life. And then you go to the petals that are filled and you say, what's working? Why am I feeling filled in my sense of connection or purpose? And you're like, huh, because, you know, I actually make an effort to connect to my community, right? Or I feel super aligned on what I came here to do. And so start to recognize what strategies are working, because then you can learn about yourself and then bring your attention. So always start with what fulfills you, right? I'm a see the glass half full person. That's where the joy comes from. Then bring that awareness to the needs that are perhaps more lacking, where you perhaps are feeling kind of an experience of poverty in, and be like, okay, choose to make that the focus of this year, right? I find this more sometimes more effective than resolutions, right? Is bringing your attention to these needs. And then here's the important part. Let's just say my need for touch is lacking. I tell people, write a list of ways that you can satisfy these needs with money, right? Maybe you go and get a massage on a regular basis. And then equally important is how do you satisfy these needs without the use of money? This is where we break our dependency on money. So I call them monetary and non-monetary strategies. So then you make that list. You're like, you know what? Maybe I'll take a risk and tell someone, hey, I'd love a hug today, right? Or maybe you'll get more hugs, right? And whatever it is that touch means to you, or maybe you're like, okay, I need to explore why is touch uncomfortable for me? And again, that may not be what everyone wants to do, but if that's where you want to bring your attention to, and then what starts to happen is that if I bring the satiation practice into the needs practice, and you start to really bring awareness to how my use of resources towards fulfillment starts to fill my cup and allows me to embody wealth and experience these moments of meaning where I'm experiencing and tapping into the power of enough, right? When that starts to happen, then you start to bring joy in your ability to design your life, channel your resources, get super creative on what monetary and non-monetary resources you have at your disposal, right? Because here's the thing, it doesn't matter if you tell me, Elizabeth, I only have a very limited amount of monetary resources for discretionary use, because what comes in goes right out. I'm like, okay, it doesn't matter if it's $10 a month, but you do have potential, some level of money to channel towards these needs. And the more intentional you become, the more powerful you feel, right? The more satisfied and the more grounded in agency in your relationship to money. And I'll end with this, Dr. Richard, because I'm super curious your thoughts on all of this. I tell everyone, no one should stand between you and your relationship to money. No financial planner, no CPA, no investment expert, right? You have a direct line to your relationship to money if you lean into it.
Let me tell you what I love about all of this. And I've been taking furious notes here as you've been talking. We talk about gratitude a lot. It's probably come up 150 times on this show in the 400 plus episodes I've recorded. But gratitude is kind of esoteric. What are you grateful for? Oh, I'm grateful for the sun and the clouds. And, yeah, you know, you're talking about, when you're talking about satiation, these are measurable,
yeah,
real, tangible things,
yeah,
that involve an actionable component. And so when you take that satiation practice and the wealth mandala and then the needs practice, you're putting into action something. And so I've talked about this plenty, pretty much everywhere, yeah, that anybody will let me talk about it. Our brains are wired in such a way as that what we put attention to, it's our reticular activating, yeah, system, it draws our focus to that. And, yeah, so if our focus is fear and scarcity, yeah, that's where our focus lies. But if our focus is, oh my God, I have figured out, you use the massage example. Okay, great. If I, you know, get two less cups of Starbucks coffee a month and I don't order as many stupid things on Amazon that don't bring me any real joy or fulfillment, I could channel that money into a massage membership somewhere, right? And, yeah, that's a tangible thing, right? That actually, yeah, brings you joy, because there is a difference, right? Gratitude, yeah, is more nebulous, and having this sense of satisfaction because you have done something, it's very different, because it puts that locus of control back on you. We don't do anything to make the sun shine, right? Like that just, it happens, right? But we do have agency in our own lives to be smarter with our money and strategic with our money to do things that bring us and our loved ones joy. So I love everything about this, Elizabeth. I wish we had more time to chat. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests a single question. That is, what is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you would like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
Yeah. So I'm going to end, Dr. Richard, with just making reference to what you just said. I would tell people, do not feel crazy because you feel scarcity. We are wired to feel scarcity. And I talk about that. And there's a whole book on the scarcity brain. So don't feel crazy that you feel it. But what you do also have is the ability to develop this new muscle around satiation and fulfillment, right? We are wired to seek. And so we need to practice fulfillment to offset that desire to seek. And that desire or that ability to embody wealth is the nugget that I want every listener to walk away with. You have the power to be enough, experience enough, and know that you're enough. And it's a daily practice that can be easy, it can be free, and you have the ability to start today with it.
Well said. And the book is The Power of Enough, Finding Joy in Your Relationship with Money, which is available everywhere that books are sold. But tell us where people can learn more about you, Elizabeth, online.
I have a website that I would very much encourage people to go explore. It's www.elizabethhusserl.com. And on that website, you'll see lots of free resources that accompany the book. So go there. There's a contact page if you want to reach out to me. If you have readers questions, send them my way. I love to answer them. And then I'm also on Instagram, handle @ElizabethHusserl. So you can find me there for more fun posts.
We love fun posts. So we will have links to everything Elizabeth Husserl in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Well, Elizabeth, this has been awesome. Thank you for writing this book because the world absolutely needs it. Really enjoyed having you on and hope we get to do this again sometime.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Richard, for having me. This has been so much fun and so much still to discuss. So have me back anytime.
Absolutely. And to each and every one of you who took time out of your day to listen to this, thank you. If you're going to go do something with this, if you're going to go create your satiation list and see what it is, do that 30-day challenge, well, give us a follow and a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post in your social media feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.